probably like he ever will. I got you all right, I got you all right. I know you probably like you never will. Got you all right, got you all right. Up through the hills, the candy in the eye gut. Listen, it's coming on the
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. My headphones aren't working. I can't hear anything. Can you hear anything, Colin?
Yes, I can.
You can hear me talking. I can. Hello, there we go. Wow, these headphones really suck. We are college radio, so always feel free to donate money to help pay for new headphones. Yeah. I'm just about to put a new pair on. Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. This is CITR, Inkstud's the show where we talk about comics. Why do we talk about comics, Colin? Because we love them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I wasn't prepared for that.
Sorry about that noise there. I just put a new pair of headphones. Oh, my God. That is so much better.
We're getting so philosophical already.
Already. Today, our special guest is Paul Hornschmeyer. I really hope I pronounce his name properly because... Anyone who's listened to Inkstuds before knows I'm a prick and mispronounce names all the time. Not on purpose, because I'm ignorant. So, we got you there, Paul?
Yes.
Did I get it right?
Yes, sort of. It's Hornschmeyer.
Horch?
But you pronounce the E in the middle, which is technically closer to the original German. So you were just being overly accurate.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag.
So, for those that don't know Paul's work, he has, at this point, four lovely collections out, the most recent being The Three Paradoxes from Fantagraphics, as well as Let Us Be Perfectly Clear, A Rarity in Comics. It's a flip book, also from Fantagraphics. Mother, Please Come Home from Dark Horse, and last but not least, Sequential from Ad Host, which, is it still in print?
No, that's out of print, and Mother Come Home, there's no please in it, but we can throw it in there, maybe when it goes back into print. That's also out of print, but that will be back in print, I think, in late summer from Fantagraphics, actually.
Yeah.
It's changing homes. It used to be Dark Horse. So.
Now, the stuff from Mother Come Home and Let Us Be Perfectly Clear was all originally printed in Forlorn Funnies, if I'm correct. Am I correct?
Right, for the most part, yeah. There's a few odds and ends in Let Us Be Perfectly Clear that were just in magazines and anthologies and things like that. But, yeah, for the most part, it was all in Forlorn Funnies.
Now, what was the song I started out with, just so people know? I forget what I played.
That was Lily's I want to say it's With Candy.
That I think that's the right name. Yeah. There we go. Any particular choice for that song? Reason? Just like it?
I don't know. I think that's one of the better pop songs I've heard in like the last 5 years. I just think it's really, really well crafted. It's really simplistic. I actually don't really like a lot of the Lily stuff. No offense to Lily's lovers, but yeah, I don't know. That song is just amazing.
Just something about it strikes.
Yes.
So I guess let's start out with talk a bit about your. I guess let's go with your biographical information. Like, who are you? How'd you get into comics? You know, the standard fare. And then we'll get, like, really in depth with your volumes of work here. Because for a young guy, you got a fair amount of stuff.
I guess. I don't know. I don't feel very young. I think I was born feeling about 80. So, how did I get into comics? I got beat up as a kid. I didn't make friends very well. I think just all the requisite, you know, sort of loser activities that pull you into the world of comics.
Yeah. The Evan Dorkin standards.
Yeah, just, you know, you lose your union card if you don't have those. No, but I mean, I think pretty standard. I mean, I started off reading what I could find, which really wasn't much. My first comic was actually from my dentist. I had a good checkup, and he had like a little treasure chest. You could get like, you know, those crappy plastic spider rings or, you know, little puzzles or whatever. And he had this free Spider-Man all detergent giveaway comic, which was still, I mean, still is sort of this, it holds this kind of mythic place in my mind. I mean, I still have it, and it's every time I look at it, I'm just like, well, no wonder this blew my mind, because it's got, you know, the origin, and it's got, you know, compares his strength to like the Hulk and to Thor, and you know, it breaks everything down in this like absolutely nerdish scientific way that I think just kind of predicted the horrible nerdish way to philosophical scientific comics I would do later. So,
what did it have to do with the actual detergent?
That's the thing. I think there were a couple ads, but yeah, I mean, it was. I don't understand. I mean, you know, it's
a giveaway. They have like the Pizza Hut ones and stuff.
Right. I mean, this is back when, you know, I mean, back in my day. But I mean, this is back when comics still were, you know, pretty cheap and
disposable.
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of, you know, it was just a newsprint kind of giveaway thing. So. But yeah, I mean, I kind of started reading comics that way, and then just, I grew up in the country, and it was a really small farming town, Georgetown, Ohio, and you really couldn't get comics. I mean, there was, I would buy them at flea markets, or at, you know, somebody was having a yard sale, maybe they were selling a few back issues, but most of the stuff I bought was just kind of old superhero stuff, so that's kind of how I got started reading comics. I think I started drawing books and stories probably when I was around 5 or 6. Sort of, you know, I'd be like, okay, I want to. It was more just to create stuff that I couldn't find. You know, I mean, I would, you know, we didn't have a lot of money when I was very young, and so I, you know, sort of, well, I want an Inspector Gadget book or whatever. Well, I would just draw it and, you know, write the story myself. I mean, of course, they were horribly bad, which sounds awful that I'm chastising myself.
Well,
I really should have been doing better work when I was 6. just my line quality was all over the map. I really needed some serious training. But, yeah, so, I mean, I think I just sort of progressed. Like a lot of people, I got a lot more serious about it when I was like, you know, 14, 15, and that's kind of what I think right around then is when Image Comics started, and I kind of got the idea, okay, you know, I think I'm going to really try to do this as a profession, but I had been doing superhero comics, and my stories were starting to get more just science fiction-y, and then they were starting to get more just psychological and fiction-oriented. And even with the creation of Image Comics, I mean, that to me was independent comics at the time because I had so little exposure to anything else. I mean, maybe I had seen, you know, Keep on Truckin' or, you know, like little Robert Crumb specs that, you know, made it through the mainstream armor, but I really had no awareness of independent or small press stuff. And the more I learned about the industry, the more I realized, you know, the stuff that I'm doing, and I don't even know, I think Vertigo might have existed then, but I mean...
It
you know,
did, really, it came out around the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there really wasn't, I think there was, what was that, there was, I think it was Marvel had kind of their creator-owned, with like
Epic
or something, yeah.
Epic line.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, there just wasn't, there wasn't really anything that I could see where mm-hmm. these stories would fit in, so I kind of stopped doing comics and decided to be a philosophy professor.
really?
yes, you know, the next most lucrative thing that I could do.
I think it might be more lucrative, actually.
Sadly, it probably
you can become
is.
A teacher.
You'll yeah, be rich yeah. as poets.
it's one step up from street urchin. So Yeah, and so I had sort of stopped, but I mean, I think it's, you know, I think when you want to draw and make stories, it's just sort of something that you, for better or worse, kind of have to do, and so I stopped for a couple years, and then a girl that I was dating in college gave me a copy of Ghost World, and I remember sitting down and reading that. This was, I think, like Christmas of my sophomore year in college. And, yeah, it was just this total revelation where I was like, oh, wait, this is more, you know, the kind of stuff that I was writing when I quit. And then I started buying a lot of, you know, Dan Klaus's stuff, which was still kind of hard because I hadn't been to a comic book shop in so mm-hmm. long, but at that point I was living in Columbus, so it was a little bit easier to get stuff.
Well, this is before Ghost World the movie came out. He was still...
That, well, there's, yeah, that too. But, I mean, you know, and I would special order some stuff in, but, you know, I bought up a lot of Dan Klaus's stuff, and then I bought a... Dave Sims' Guide to Self-Publishing, or whatever it is, Cerebus' Guide to Self-Publishing, or mm-hmm. something like that, which is this, you know, I don't know, maybe like 80-page newsprint screed about, you know, how you should never have a publisher and all this stuff. Not that Dave writes really long screeds about anything.
No.
But it was actually
color.
Really useful. And I remember buying... 32 stories, which I think Drawn yep. Quarterly put yep. that out, I think. And, you know, kind of seeing Adrian's, like, path from, you know, self-publishing and stuff, and I was like, oh, you know, this is kind of, like, maybe I could do this, you know. So then I started self-publishing. And
that's when you started with Sequential?
Right, yeah. Well, my very, very beginning was doing daily strips in the Ohio State University, you have to say the year, they'll sue you, Ohio State University's newspaper, The Lantern, which is it's actually where Bone started also.
Really?
They're pretty supportive of cartoonists in that paper, and they were like, you know, Ohio State has a cartoon art museum there, so I could, you know, go and look at, like, original Walt Kellys and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great resource. So,
something tells
so
me
it started gestating that way, and then, yeah, it just kind of went on from there. And now my life is ruined.
You've gotten the bite of the dragon that is known as comics and keep chasing it and quite can't catch up to it.
Yeah, this is all true.
Now, how far did you go with the philosophy in school?
Well, I mean, I got my degree in philosophy. I mean, I was studying philosophy, and I was, you know, like I said, I was kind of like, okay, you know, I'll be a professor. And both my parents have degrees in philosophy. They're lawyers, and my mother's a judge, but that's, you know, kind of where they got their start academically, and so I think I came by it pretty honestly. But about 2 years into it, I really realized what a sort of self-feeding circle academia is, and I realized that no one, because my interest was mainly, when I say philosophy, people are like, oh man, cool, you know,
yeah,
talk no. about God, man, you know,
no.
and certainly I like to think about, you know, the bigger questions in life, but my focus was more on, you know, modern physics and logic and, you know, things that were essentially zeros and ones and things like that, and I realized how much people don't really want to solve problems. They just sort of want to create their own nomenclature for things and then spend 40 pages explaining the new terms that they've come up with. And that really wasn't appealing to me. So, yeah.
I thought I was, like, reading and the, I guess, the solemnness of your work. Kind of, I thought, you know, with the philosophy, I thought maybe there's some kind of stoicism kind of thrown in there.
No, I think it's just I'm kind of a natural-born mope. I'm just normally sad. Slash completely manic. So, yeah, I think I sort of vacillate between those two things pretty honestly, and doesn't really have anything to do with a thought-out philosophy or anything like that. But you can pretend that it is.
I'll pretend I'm all okay, cool, introspective and interesting and have these things that
absolutely
are not way off base.
Oh, I have a, yeah, I have a, like a 20-page manifesto about the tone of my comic. I'll send it to you later.
Well, does your studies and philosophies affect your comics, inform you?
Yes and no. Certainly in the last book, Three Paradoxes, I mean, there's some pretty direct philosophy stuff. I mean, there's, you know, Zeno and Parmenides, and I think I have a horrible philosophy joke in the back that hopefully I didn't offend my mother by running about Heraclitus, but who's just an endless source of comedy. But I don't know. I mean, it's sort of that I think the studies and my stories kind of all come from the same place. I mean, they're just sort of things that I think about all the time anyway. So I think that's why I studied philosophy, and I think it's the same reason that I write my stories the way I do, however that is, crappily, I don't know, whatever.
What was there a moment when you realized you could talk about philosophy in comics?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly when that was. I mean, again, you know, it sort of, I think, just all kind of stems from a common place. So I think these are things I was thinking about and writing about anyway. And I do try, to some degree, to not make it too explicit as far as, you know, talking about philosophical stuff. I mean, obviously, the Three Paradoxes, I kind of had to make it explicit since it was sort of revolving around this philosophical concept, these paradoxes of Zeno's, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there really was any. I mean, I just feel like I'm still figuring out how to do comics, and I feel like maybe when I'm 80, I'll be like, no, now I know, you know, or something. But I just like, I mean, every day, you know, that's the thing. Like, somebody will write me a nice letter or something about one of the books, and it's always very flattering, and I'm always very appreciative. But I just, you know, I feel like I'm pulling one over on them because I feel like it's just sort of me still trying to figure out how any of this works.
I think that's kind of a common thread among cartoonists, though, is because
it needs to be evolving
media.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, and I've had this conversation with other authors, and I think it's, you know, if you feel like you haven't figured out, then you're probably not really going to be doing much else that's interesting, you know. Mm-hmm.
So, you'd be pulling a Dave Sim. I mean, oops.
What's that? Sorry.
I was just saying you'd probably be pulling a Dave Sim.
Poor Dave. We've already picked on him twice.
I know. I saw Glamour Puss and I was very, we'll leave it at that.
All right.
I've seen some of the separate issues of Forlorn Funnies, but I already had the collection, so I stuck with the collection when I came across the issues.
Right.
But it seems like you're experimenting pretty early on as far as like trying to do something different with how you're putting out a comic, like not just a standard, you know, 32-page
right.
floppy, but it just seems like design was an important aspect for you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, again, that kind of gets back to, I mean, yeah, even from, you know, sequential on, I mean, right from when I started, I think it's, and it just really came from not knowing what I was doing, and kind of, I tend to overthink everything anyway, so I mean, my comics certainly aren't any different. So if I'm going to tell the story, I mean, you know, it's sort of, okay, well, you know, how do I want to tell it? What's the pacing? What's that? But then I also want to think about, like, well, what's the line quality? What should, you know, and even what kind of paper should this be on? What, you know, should it be square? Should it be tall? Like, you know, all those things to me, even early on, and it really was not something that I was like, I will now think about all these things. It just all seemed like part of it, so it all seemed like something that I should consider just, you know, kind of right from the beginning. Now that I've been doing it for a while, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that seems advisable to think about all those things, but I'm just a control freak, basically.
An auteur.
Right, that's the nice way to put it. I'm sure everyone who has ever dated me would probably not put it that nicely, but yeah, I tend to be a perfectionist about stuff, so I mean, I think that it's all kind of tied into that, but again, we can paint some really nice conceptual picture of it if we want, you know. Yeah.
I'm going to play a quick song. What would you like me to play?
How about, I'm forgetting what I picked, how about the Manfred Krug song?
Sounds awesome. We'll be back in a sec with Paul Hornschmeyer. Did I get it right that time?
Yes, that's
awesome. Great. High five. CITR 101.9 FM, this is Ink Studs, and we'll be right back.
Du sagtest leider nur Gute Nacht und sahst mich schräg von oben an. Ich hätte dich gern nach Haus gebracht, doch du erzähltest nur von einem anderen Mann. Er sei wunderbar, er sei so stark, blondes Haar und die Figur so schön wie nur im alten Rom. Sei sein Gang und ich sei längst nicht so lang. Er habe Schultern wie ein Turm vom Kölner Dom. Dann lud ich dich noch zum Kaffee in mein möbliertes Zimmer ein. Wir saßen auf dem Kanapee und tranken nach dem Kaffee Wein. Und du sagtest du, und er sei eng, dein neuer Schuh. Wir legten barfuß eine Sohle aufs Parkett. Reizend war der Abend, so erfrischend und so labend. Ich schlief unten auf dem Teppich, du im Bett. Dich noch zum Kaffee in mein möbliertes Zimmer ein. Wir saßen auf dem Kanapee und tranken nach dem Kaffee Wein. Und du sagtest du, und er sei eng, dein neuer Schuh. Wir tanzten Barfußbeat nach Walzern von Herrn Strauß.
Du, nicht doch.
Gefiel dir gut, so fasste ich langsam Mut und nach dem Heiratsantrag brachte ich dich nach Haus.
CITR 101.9 FM. That's got me.
What the hell was that?
That was great.
That's Manfred Krug.
Oh.
I first heard his music, somebody was just playing it on like this little 45 in a photography shop in, I think, in Weimar, Germany, and I was just like, what is this? It's like the German Burt Bacharach. it's pretty amazing.
He brought the rock.
Mm-hmm.
That was awesome.
Yeah, I like him. But apparently he's better known as an actor. I mentioned Manfred Krug to my German publisher, and he was like, what? How do you know Manfred Krug? And he was like, you know him from his movies? I was like, his movies. So there you go.
An all-around entertainer.
Multi-talented guy.
So how did you get hooked up with your Morgan Mitchell homies?
What's that? Sorry?
Your friends, Mr. Jeffrey Brown, Anders Nilsson, and John Hankovich.
Oh, yes. Did you say Margot Mitchell? Is that what you said?
Morgan Mitchell. Did I get it wrong?
Oh, Margot Mitchell is my fake company. Margot is my cat.
In Canada, Margot's got the cargo and Reggie's got the rig. It's a Stompin' Tom Connor song about making clocks out of poop.
Yeah, Margot Mitchell sounded better than, you know, Paul Hornschmeyer illustration and design. So that's what that comes from. The Holy Consumption is
there. We go.
Is Jeffrey and Anders and John. Was the question how it got started, or
yeah, how you got connected with those boys, and how have they affected your own cartooning? When you started,
I've never been the same.
Hanging out with people.
I cry nightly. basically, I mean, I had met, and hopefully I'm not getting this wrong, I think this is accurate. I met John and Anders at a sort of a punk zine festival in Bowling Green, Ohio. And this is when I still lived in Ohio. And Anders, you know, lived in Chicago at the time, and I think John, I want to say he had lived in, like, Arizona or something like that, or Arkansas or something, but I think he was back in the Chicago area. But I think I'd maybe put out, like, Sequential number 4 or 5 or something. It was maybe, like, my second or third convention, and most of the stuff that was there was, like, you know, why we should free all the prisoners and, you know...
Yeah.
Give yourself your own vaginal exam. 5 easy steps. You know, I mean, just all these, like, uber punk.
Free Mumia Jamal punk now.
Punk. Yeah.
Vegetarians against the Nazis.
So, yeah, I think we sort of, you know.
Stuck out?
We're drawn together, you know, just out of solidarity and the fact that we were, like, 3 of the only people that had comics there. So I had, you know, mentioned their comics and my comic, kind of giving them a plug or whatever, you know, for the 2.5 years that I had. And when I moved to Chicago, I think I had gotten in touch with them, with John and Anders. And then at the time I was working, when I moved to Chicago, I was working for a Canadian printing company, Westcan Printing Group in Winnipeg, and acting as their, like, you know, state's representative or whatever. And
that sounds very official.
Yes, it was very official. Not really.
Do they pay you in Canadian?
Yes. What's that?
Do they pay you in Canadian?
They paid me in American. But,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. Though I remember initially that really thoroughly confusing my bank. But but everything confuses my bank. They're really bad. but... I'm trying to remember how this worked. Well, I had met, I was working with Dan Rayburn from, mm-hmm. who was putting out The Imp.
Yeah.
And
fantastic.
Yeah, just amazing stuff. And he introduced me to Chris Ware at some point, and then Chris Ware called me at some point and said, you know, oh, I know this person, Jeffrey Brown, who wants to put together his book to, you know, actually be printed. Do you think you could help him out? So Jeff came over, and Jeff was, I remember his initial impression was that he was surprised because he thought I was going to be some 40-year-old washed-up guy. So basically we spent about a week putting together Clumsy. I scanned all the pages of Clumsy, and then Jeff did
the journal
cleanup and stuff. Right, we scanned the actual. I can't remember. You know, I don't know if we scanned the actual sketchbook or if we scanned printouts of it, because he had already done a self-published Xerox version of it. So, but anyway, so basically, we were going to the small press convention in Maryland, SPX, and he, you know, with his printed out copy, and I think that's where. Maybe Forlorn. I think Forlorn Funnies 1 was already out, because I was working on Forlorn Funnies 1 when we were working on Clumsy. And I realized that there was no way, because he didn't have a publisher or anything like that, and I kind of realized, you know, there's no way for him to really kind of sell this once, you know, we can go to the convention, great, but if people like it, then there's kind of nothing that we can do afterward. Because he didn't even have distribution or anything like that. So, you know, I kind of had this idea of, like, a collective type thing, and I asked Anders and John about it, and they were into it too. And yeah, now that we're all highfalutin, we don't sell stuff on the site anymore, and I've been so busy in the last month, I haven't even updated it. But but it's still hanging in there. So,
yeah. You've all gone to your separate publishers, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it was kind of weird because our careers, if you want to call them that, sounds too fancy pants, I think, but kind of all moved at the same rate. When it started, we all, none of us had publishers, none of us had, book deals of any sort with anyone. It's just all kind of slowly started around the same time. And, obviously now we have publishers, so. The need for the commerce side of it is gone a little bit, but
now you can get more into the creative,
right? Yeah, exploits. I mean now it's just more of a straight, putting stuff up, and letting people see what we do, because that is one problem with comics is that it is so insular, and you do tend to really not see your fans except for maybe like once a year or a couple times a year or something. So mm-hmm. There is kind of this disconnect,
It's an isolating profession.
Yeah, definitely. To some degree, it's just sort of to show people what you're doing and to kind of maintain some semblance of sanity, I guess.
Mother Come Home, was that your first thing at a longer story narrative, or was it the last sequential? Was your
I really had only done, I'd done one maybe 20-page story, Ex Falso Claude Libet, which was in sequential. I don't really remember exactly how long that was, but, 20, 25 pages or something. So, it was the first longer thing I'd done. I think I'd wanted to do longer stuff, but, I'd wanted to do longer stuff and I'd wanted to do color, but when it came down to it, I just wasn't good enough at all. I'm sure some people would debate I wasn't good enough to even do Mother Come Home, but but I thought I'd give it a try anyway. So, yeah.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What was the kind of the idea behind it? Because it seems like a very personal book.
Mm-hmm. What was the idea behind it? There wasn't any, singular idea behind it. It kind of came out of a few different things. I had been dating someone for a really long time, and they kind of left and moved to a different state, and I'd kind of had my life kind of wrapped up in that and sort of had all my plans. I thought I had everything kind of set and all, that I knew exactly what was going on with my life, and I think very much for the better that fell apart. But there was, sort of that was going on in my personal life, and then, I remember I was home visiting at one point and kind of looking at my parents, who are, still together and are still living, which a lot of people, when they read the book, think that my parents are dead. but they're not.
I guess that's what the three paradoxes is for.
Yeah, well, actually, that was one thing, was just to piss people off that were like, what? His dad's,
it was all a dream?
Exactly, it was a dream.
They were disappointed?
There were some people that, it is weird because I do get, I'll get the occasional email from somebody that, tells me this like really, really personal story, and that's, it's great that the book, affected them or reminded them of something, and hopefully was cathartic in some way, but it's kind of weird because I do feel like sort of this emotional tourist, and that for me it's a work of fiction. There are certainly elements in it that are like the relationship between the father and son and sort of how they interact is very much how I've interacted with my father and kind of how our relationship is to some degree. Certainly not the extent to which the father is kind of pulling away from reality, and my father is certainly not like that at all, but and there are certain aspects that are kind of, I won't really go into the specifics out of respect to my family, but that are kind of biographical, dealing with my father and his father. Then there's things that were inspired by, other people. One of them was actually my symbolic logic professor in college, who I actually don't know what happened, but I know his wife was sort of on death's door due to an anti-malaria vaccination that she had taken that she'd had a really adverse reaction to. And he just kind of lost it in the middle of class one time, and that left a huge impression on me, kind of this person who, you know, his whole life was kind of logic and zeros and ones and control, and he was completely powerless. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw a lot of myself kind of in that situation, because I think I do tend to, as I said earlier, be, you know, try to kind of control all these little variables and stuff, and that's just not life, you know. Life is obviously a lot more chaotic than that, so. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, let's be perfectly clear, the flipbook, mm-hmm. I guess I love flipbooks. It's great.
just to specify, I mean, for people who haven't seen it, it's not a, like, animation flipbook.
It's right. When you flip upside down.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's usually when you have two different artists involved.
Right, true.
Or books. Was the humor portion to it something you kind of felt you needed to just get out there so people didn't think you're moping away into delirium?
Well, I mean, that's the comedic stuff. I mean, people are often really confused when they meet me, probably just, you know, on a lot of different levels. But, like, what are you trying to say? I think people are really confused in that, you know, I do tend to be very jokey and, you know, I think for the most part pretty jovial and stuff. I mean, the comedy is just as much a part of my ideas, you know, and storytelling as anything else. And that was, you know, something with Mother Come Home is that, I mean, it sort of had to be what it is in order to tell that story. I mean, it is this very, very specific, you know, territory in the emotional terrain, but to me, I mean, to a large degree, it sort of felt a little dishonest, because obviously, you know, that's not what life is, you know. I mean, that's not what most of life is like. I mean, yes, certainly there are sort of these crushing lows, but there's also these great highs, and you know, there's a lot of joking and stuff like that. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the Let Us Be Perfectly Clear was kind of wanting to show more of that. And I mean, that was kind of something that I tried to do in The Three Paradoxes, mm-hmm. too, just, you know, have it be more of a blend of kind of everything.
I'd actually, one more comment about Mother Come Home. It was the fact that it seems, one thing I really appreciate about it as far as being a reader is that you kind of take a snapshot of a certain point in time,
right.
But you leave a lot for the reader to kind of figure out for themselves and stuff.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that's kind of just the storytelling that I really prefer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean...
And, like, Return of the Elephant is like that, too. Where
right.
It's just, like, I find excellent, excellent short story where it's just, like, you read it and you kind of left with it being, like, kind of, like, kind of awkward.
I once had a guy at a convention walk up to me and say, and he pointed at Return of the Elephant was, you know, its own book at one point,
mm-hmm.
Published by Ad House Books, which is a great company. And he pointed to the book and he's like, I really related to this. And for anybody who's read that story, that's the wrong story to relate to. I did not ask him why. I was just sort of waiting for him to leave the table. But,
that's when you get distracted by something at the table next to you.
Right, right. I gotta go where you're not. I mean, I think sort of, you know, I don't know if elliptical storytelling to some degree is the right term, but, I mean, what I grew up really loving was, like, you know, Edward Gorey books and stuff like that, where it's kind of, you know, a lot of times Edward Gorey is sort of telling this story, but at the same time you're not sure exactly what's going on, and my mother and I would always watch, you know, like, Mystery on public broadcasting and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and... which, you know, strangely enough, has an Edward Gorey animated beginning to
it.
But I think I was always really drawn to, you know, kind of mysteries and stories that tell so much with leaving stuff out. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm drawn to comics is because that's sort of so much of the engine of comics is kind of what's not there. I mean, it's kind of what's in the gutter, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the movement.
It's what makes it sequential is that
right,
you can kind of
exactly.
see snapshots of points in time. But it doesn't need to be completely literal.
Right, right. So, I mean, I think that's directors that I like, writers that I like, you know, I've always kind of been drawn to that, people who say a lot without actually saying it, you know.
And I guess these trespassing vehicles is another kind of story like that.
Right. I mean, that one's, yeah, it was sort of even stranger. I don't know what to say about that one. So people can read that one. Send me hate mail.
Do you get hate mail?
I've only gotten a few people for the most part. I feel like if they're going to put in the time to write, you know, it usually is because things affected them in a pretty positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And most of anything I've gotten that was critical, for the most part, I felt like it was pretty fair. I don't usually get like some, you know, really horrible letter just like, you suck, why don't you die a lot? You know, I mean, there isn't any of that. but I don't know. I mean, people tend to be, I mean, but I'm also not really that keen on just getting letters that are just full of, you know, hyperbole and, you know, just kind of blowing up my ego. That's nice. Don't get me wrong. Keep those letters coming. But because my horrible self-esteem could always use it. But people tend to be pretty supportive. I mean, comics is a pretty small community in that way. I think people tend to be pretty nice about stuff. So. For better or worse, I don't know.
Now, your main thing you're working on right now is it Life with Mr. Dangerous?
The main story of mine I'm working on right now. I feel like I'm working on other people's stuff a little bit too much right now. But
Omega the Unknown?
Yes, Omega the Unknown. That's the entire next 5 days are going to be, you know, from probably about 7 a.m. to 7 a.m. working on that. So gotta get the next issue out.
How did you get into the whole coloring thing? Was it just people liked the hues you used in your own stuff and kind of said, hey, do you want to color this for me?
I think so. I mean, I'm trying to remember. I don't even know what the first thing I colored was. It was probably for Diana Schutz, who's, I think you guys are having her on sometime soon, right?
Yeah, next
she's
month.
One of my favorite people in the world. Super nice. But I don't remember. I honestly don't recall what the first thing was that I colored, but I'm sure it was something for Diana, maybe in
one of her anthologies.
Yeah, it might have been for The Escapists, or I know I did. I colored a Jason strip for the Star Wars comic, which is, I can't think of a weirder combination.
Doesn't
he
color his own stuff, too?
I think he's colored his own stuff. I'm pretty sure he works with a colorist.
Like
his most recent full color books. I could be wrong. I'm sure the Fantagraphics could.
But it has a similar
muted color sense.
Right, I mean, there's a lot of kind of earth tones, muted tones. I really love his full colors. I mean, his black and white stuff's amazing, too. But that I Killed Adolf Hitler book is seriously one of the best crafted books. I mean, after I read that, I was just like, I quit. Like, the fact that he pulled that off in, I mean, I think it was 48 pages or something.
Yeah, if that.
It's insane.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Jason's the guy that does those weird dog faces for Fantagraphics.
Yeah.
And we talked about him at our year-end wrap-up show. We actually brought in I Killed Adolf Hitler, one of the best of the year.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
I'm curious to see his next collection that comes out that's all his Love and Rockets looking early stuff.
Right, yeah. I'll be interested to see that. I think Jacob Covey or somebody posted one of those pages on the Comics Journal, or not Comics Journal, the Fantagraphics blog or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I saw some in Fantagraphic sends out a little solicitation, so what's coming out in the next 6 months, and I saw something, it's like, weird.
Yeah, I know, it just doesn't look anything like his stuff. But
back to you, though.
Let's just talk about Jason.
Does he even speak English?
He does. He's a very nice guy.
How did you get connected with Dalrymple for Omega the Unknown?
Well, Farrell and I have been friends for probably longer than he would like.
Or it's the other way around.
Oh, no, that's absolutely not true. Farrell's awesome.
He's a troublemaker.
He is a troublemaker. I'll give him that. I met Farrell. I was still living in Columbus. I met him at the Space Convention, the small press convention in Columbus, a convention that I have a great love for, but unfortunately haven't made it to a couple of times. Since it's been running, I can't remember if that might have been the first one I was at, maybe the second one that I was at. So this would have been like, I don't know, like 2000 or something. So, you know, it's been like 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. We kind of became friends, and then when I went to New York, I hung out with him, and he introduced me to, you know, his friends. I remember him showing me James Jean's sketchbook, who was, I think James was maybe like 21 at that point. I remember Farrell stopping me before I looked at it. He's like, man, you're never going to want to draw again. And I was like, oh, come on, this kid can't be that. Oh, my God. I'm like, like, what? Leonardo da Vinci threw up all over this page. This is amazing. Yeah, it's that guy's, whew, he's good. Yeah, so, I mean, Farrell and I have just been friends for a long time, and then I colored, he did a Flash Superman story in Bizarro that I colored.
Well, it seems like the two of you kind of have a similar aesthetic.
Yeah,
to,
I mean,
to
yeah,
like the type of stories.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're both kind of drawn to similar things. I mean, I think his is a little bit more in the maybe like straight surrealism, magic realism kind of stuff, as far as like the Pop Gun War stuff. But but yeah, I mean, it's weird because I feel like both of us kind of are drawn to, which is, I think, is perfect that we're working with Jonathan Lethem on Omega the Unknown, because I think we're all three of us are kind of big fans of like kind of early 70s, late 60s superhero comics and stuff like that. So I think there's something in our aesthetics that, you know, that kind of brushwork that we like.
Here's a question about it, and I still want to get to more of your stuff, but how was it coloring Gary Panther?
Coloring Gary Panther, it was kind of really daunting, honestly, because, I mean, I'm a huge Gary Panther fan, and, I mean, you know, obviously be hard-pressed to think of a more influential artist in comics. But in a lot of ways, honestly, I just tried to be Gary and just color it the way that I took out about 20 examples of his coloring and then just tried to ape that, because I was like, I can't even begin to try to color this like me, you know, because it's going to be totally wrong.
So you're going for more pop colors. More.
Yeah. I mean, that was just, you know, I mean, I even did some tests, coloring it with crayons and colored pencils and just, you know, just trying to do really strange stuff. I ended up sticking with computer coloring, but, you know, sort of knocked it all off register and made it these, like, crazy. I thought Marvel was just, when I sent them the first, like, the cover for issue 7, I figured there's no way. Like,
you thought they'd bust a nut?
Oh, I mean, I figured they'd just, yeah, turn it down immediately and say, like, we're not publishing that. Are you kidding me? Like, recolor it. But they...
So he just gave, I wasn't sure if he gave, like, I thought maybe he colored the, like, sent in a painting cover, but you actually, it was just pencils and you colored it?
It was, yeah, inks. He just sent black and white ink stuff. Yeah, and his page is the same thing. Yeah, it's just black and white artwork.
Because it, like, honestly, it looks like, you know, if this compliment, it looks like Gary Panther colors on the cover. So you did good.
Well, that's good. That's what I was looking for. I mean, because that's, you know, I feel like that's kind of what the artwork needed, and that's the same way that I kind of do everything. I mean, if I feel like I'm doing a story and I feel like, well, this kind of needs to look like, you know, Dennis the Menace or something, then I'm going to draw it a little bit more like Hank Ketchum or whatever, you know. And I think coloring is kind of the same thing, you know. If the artwork needs to look like it's colored by Gary Panther, then that's, you know, kind of what I'm going to try to do.
Do you do any of your own work? Is it all hand-colored or computer-colored, your own work?
For the most part, there's been a couple things. I'm actually going to be doing more comics where I think I'm going to work with colored pencil, because I've been doing that more lately, and that's actually a lot of fun to do. For the most part, almost everything is, yeah, colored in the computer. I mean, it's usually just, it's a lot faster, and you know, the control that you have, again, getting back to the control freak.
You know what, though? It's true, though. Like, I talk to a lot of people, and they can do so much with the computer, and then someone for the art show did his first piece, like, wasn't on computer in years, and it's such a challenge for him, because he was so, like... He did something, and it's like, that's not what I wanted. How do I undo that?
No, it is strange. I've talked with people about that where, you know, but fortunately, I mean, I go back and forth every day between, you know, I mean, I'll be drawing on the artboard and using you know, using the stuff that people have been using forever. I mean, I'm just, you know, using a pencil and brush and putting on white, you know, opaque white to correct things and stuff like that. So I think I don't completely get into that, but I've noticed if I work too much on the computer that I kind of freak out when I'm doing other stuff because it's like, what? I can't, what, Apple Z, what? Oh, you know, and then I just cry.
And there's still white out.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I think you just, which is, that is one problem with computers is that kind of infinite editability, which is not a word, I don't think. But
that's okay. It's cool.
New words.
It's the,
I think
the
it,
Coachella.
I think it gives you a false sense of control is what I was going to say. That, and I think that's kind of, can be bad for art, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's back to the old Kotelka thing. The, you know, sometimes you just got to put it out and just let it speak for itself, I guess, without putting too
much
thought
into it. Right, and I think that's true. I mean, that was actually kind of a major epiphany for me was just kind of putting out my first book, you know, when I just went and photocopied the thing and put it out. And I was really embarrassed by it, and I wasn't happy with it, and I did the next thing, and I kind of realized, like, well, that's just kind of how you do it. I mean, you put out the thing, you're always going to be dissatisfied, you know, or I hope, you know, that you would be at least to some degree dissatisfied with whatever you put out so that you're improving. But, yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, exactly. I think you just kind of got to put it out there and, you know, warts and all. And, yeah.
So what's the plan with Life with Mr. Dangerous?
I don't know.
it's just one of those things where you've got, like, a couple of pages in mind at a time and just kind of see where her story goes?
Yes and no. Well, at this point, definitely no. At this point, everything's completely, I've got every single panel planned out. I've got the entire book designed and everything. Because, I mean, I already had to send all that stuff to, the book's being collected by Random House.
Oh, wow.
So I already had to send all that stuff.
You're one of those real book people.
Yes, it's going to be a real book, unlike those fake books that Fantagraphics put out. just as real as the other books. So, I mean, initially when I was starting it off, there were, and this is kind of how I did Mother Come Home, too, where there were kind of key scenes. And then, you know, I already had the ending in mind and then, you know, certain key points that the characters need to get to. And then the characters just kind of write themselves to those key scenes, you know. I mean, they kind of, it sounds weird and sounds like I'm, well, probably as insane as I actually am. But, you know, the characters will tell you what they need to do, you know.
Well, that's, you know, though, like Jaime was the same way when we had him on. Mm-hmm. He just went off, like, the characters just write themselves. He can't write them, like, he can't tell them
true.
Where to go.
And, I mean, I think that, I mean, Charles Schulz talked about that, too. You know, you sort of create these characters, and if they're really well-defined characters, if you've kind of, you know, done your job in crafting those characters, they do kind of, you know, tell you what they need, and, you know, there's going to be sentences that maybe you come up with that they're like, no, I wouldn't say that. so basically, I'm really crazy. This is not good.
We're all crazy.
Exactly. I mean, as far as Life and Mr. Dangerous, at least for, you know, the first initial chunks, it was just kind of, okay, well, here's what needed to happen in the scene, and, you know, here's where she needs to end up, and then you just kind of plan that out chapter by chapter, and I think it's a lot more fun working that way. The three paradoxes, I did kind of like write out the entire script, and which was kind of necessary because it's so kind of non-linear and using five different drawing styles or six or whatever it is.
That's something we haven't even had a chance to touch on at all, and that's your most recent
publication. I mean, doing something like that, it kind of had to be a script before, you know, really getting too much into the art. I really don't like working that way. I mean, it's boring, basically. I mean, because you kind of feel like you, because for me, the really, really fun part is the writing. I like drawing, but drawing comics is, oh my God, it's like
laborious.
Yeah, it's hard work.
Like sticking a pickaxe in your eye or something.
So the
quote me on that.
The three paradoxes, is that autobiographical, semi-autobiographical,
or using yourself as a character?
Yes. all three. There are plenty of things that are autobiographical. I mean, that, you know, that is my, you know, my parents' house. That's my dad. That's, you know, basically what we look like. We did go on that walk through the town. Some of the conversations that we have while we're walking, I will say all the conversations that we had on that walk really did happen. But, for instance, there's one conversation where he says something about going to this monastery and doing chanting, and, you know, that he feels like he's been selfish in his relationship with my mother or something like that. And that conversation did happen, but that happened in a car on the north side of Chicago. So things like that. I mean, you, and I think you're going to see that in any autobiographical work, you know, people moving things around to kind of make a more cohesive narrative out of it. Obviously, the exchange between, you know, Zeno and sort of punkish Socrates, I took some liberties with that. I don't have good documented evidence that really happened, or that they look like they're from a Jay Ward cartoon. But and then the sort of kind of 70s looking story about the, you know, kid that gets in the sort of debilitating accident, that has some basis in reality, but that's actually, to some degree, and I don't want to get into too many specifics because I don't want to get myself sued, but that has to do with someone that, you know, I know, but I actually don't know how he got the disfigurement that he has. And it's one of those things that, you know, I think everybody's sort of crafted their own belief or narrative or story based off of hearsay and things like that. I mean, that story and kind of the way it was told is sort of based off of growing up in a small town, and that I think so often that's sort of how we form these stories about people.
Is your trips to home bring about a lot of introspection?
I would say just about anytime I leave my apartment, not just going home, but definitely when I go home, because it is, I mean, where I grew up is very different from, you know, I live in Chicago now, I live in Columbus, and, I mean, it's a tiny town. My school, my class had like 90 people in it. I knew, you know, I went to kindergarten with everybody that I graduated with, you know, and it's a very, very, very small town. So, you know, it's definitely a very different reality. And there's something that I definitely have a nostalgia for it in certain ways, but then in other ways there's, yeah, I mean, it's a very much a mixed thing for me. So, I think, I mean, I guess it makes me think about a lot of stuff when I go back there.
I have the next show staring at me.
Okay.
like, oh, it's 3. So what we can have to look forward in the future is Life with Mr. Dangerous.
Right.
And anything else?
Omega the Unknown. There's actually going to be a big Omega the Unknown event in April in New York. It's going to be Gary Panther, Jonathan Leetham, Farrell, me, I think a couple other people. I'm probably missing some names, but people.
Those are the main guys.
Yes.
You guys are the main guys.
You should stop by, check it out. Yeah, I don't know. Other than that, just, yeah, a lot of crying and sweat.
And maybe a little music.
And maybe a little music, yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I
thanks for having me.
Look forward to the next moment.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. We kind of went a little over time, so next week, James Stern will be our guest. And I forgot to ask him what song to play, so I'm just going to play the Rufus Wainwright because it gets my CanCon content. And Crimes and Treasons up next.
There I was in uniform, looking at the art teacher. I was just a girl then. Love since then. You that much older than I was. He had taken a class to the Metropolitan Museum. He asked us what our favorite work of art was. Never could I tell him it was him. So I wish I could tell him. Oh, I wish I could have told.